From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, we're doing an entire hour on magic books. So why, you might be wondering. Well, you'd know if you were in our office a couple of weeks ago. That's when the book arrived. It was huge, 14 by 20, weighed close to 10 pounds. And it's full of bizarre illustrations and calligraphy in a made-up language. The book really got us excited. Everybody wanted to touch it, to borrow it, to talk about it. It felt like magic. And the title, well, just as mysterious, Codex Serafinianus. And who is Luigi Serafini, the author? Our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, sat down with Charles Myers, the publisher of Rizzoli Press, to get to the bottom of it.
Can you, and this probably be the hardest thing you'll do all day, can you describe this book?
That is the hardest thing I'll do all day. You know, it's a fantasy with illustrations and calligraphy following the structure of an atlas or a travel book from the 17th or 18th century, I would say. Some reference to illuminated manuscripts. And it's difficult to interpret, but wonderful to experience. And it bounces, I guess, between sort of references to a distant past and explorations of a distant future. How's that for a mouthful?
That was a big mouthful. I think there's a couple words that I don't think need to go in there. One, it is surreal. I mean, if you want to define surreal, boom, this is it. Can you pick a page for me that you really like? Because once you describe a page, you'll be like, oh, it is quite bizarre.
Well, I think the one of the signature pages, but there are so many, but one of the signature pages is of a series of illustrations of a couple making love, and they gradually morph into the shape of a single alligator. And then as the drawings go on, or as the alligator slowly, one imagines, gets off the bed and disappears, leaving just this blank bed. And that's the kind of wonderful metamorphosis that you experience in every page.
My favorite page, and of course I can't give the page number because we also failed to mention that the language in this and the calligraphy written is made up, or presumably made up. It could be by an angel or an alien. We can talk about that later. But it's made up, and it's kind of three people, human-looking people, mushroom-head people with spurs on their boots, and there's a bunch of skeletons waiting in line. And on one end, there's some dead bodies, the skin's being taken off. The skeletons are waiting in line to get the skin put back on them. And then there's a bunch of writing around it in this made-up language. And then, of course, the skeletons are lying on a bed of books. And I'm like, I don't even know where to start with that. It's actually fantastic.
It is indeed. I mean, there are all kinds of wonderful things that one brings from one's own visual encyclopedia. You know, is it gore, Edward Gorey? Is it steampunk?
Right.
To go back to the word surreal you used, when Serafini was first working in Rome in the 60s and 70s. This was a time when Fellini was still very active, and they were friends. De Chirico was still alive, you know, the great surrealist, Italian surrealist artists and filmmakers and so forth were all still about, and I think he was very influenced by the mood in Rome at the time.
You know, for me, I lived in Prague for many years, and I had a couple of friends who were really into alchemy, and there's an alchemy museum in Prague, quite a real one, quite serious, and they had a alchemy book exhibit once that we went to, and the original of the Codex was there, and it blew my mind. And these guys were convinced, my friend at the time, I didn't know any better, that this was connected to the Aleppo Codex, the Codex for the New Testament, and that this was one that was written in a secret language that actually maintained the real truth of God, and something they wanted to get their hands on, and they wanted to break in and actually read it. It was really interesting stuff. Which gets into my next question. People put a lot of meaning. I went on the internet searching around for this book. Oh my God, there's some really weird websites and blog settings for this book. Why do you think people put so much meaning into it? What are some of the things people are talking about with it?
What are people talking about now? There's a lot of blogging about this. People are still trying to decode it. There's been a rich literature on the pagination
What is it, Code 21 or something?
Code 21, right. Yes. I've not been able to unlock that or even
<Me neither. laughs>
really try to. But the folios, apparently, if you understand codes, work in formulas of the number 21. I think people are, first of all, thrilled to see it back and available. And that sparked a whole new dialogue about it. And many, many people that I've seen are talking about how they've been trying to figure it out for 20 years. unsuccessfully, I might add.
Well, you know, it goes back to the alchemist, right? Maybe, you know, salvation is in the journey, right? So maybe they spent 20 years trying to figure out that is the point.
I think that's exactly the point. And I think the process of that is very much Serafini's point.
Now, this has been translated. There was a linguist in Bulgaria who I think was a contemporary when I lived in that part of the world who translated this, right? Or thinks he translated it.
I thinks he translated it, I think, would be the right thing. I mean, the calligraphy is – there are different words that have been used. It's a semic or it's a conlang. It's I always think of it as automatic writing,
right.
Which is something the surrealists used. But it's played very effectively now too because I think there's a resonance with a lot of graffiti and street art where – people do make up their own languages and their own signs, and I think that's something very contemporary.
We should keep in mind that this wasn't written in the 1300s. This was written in the 70s. You know the author. He's done other books. He does children's books. What does he say of all this about his codex?
He's appropriately sort of built a mystique around it.
Yeah, good man, good man.
he has said a few things. His comments on the writing basically center on the fact that he thinks it's a liberating experience, that you can't understand the writing itself, and he's denied that it has any real meaning. I think that what he really means by that is that when you do look at an old book or you do look at the codex, you often don't understand what is being said. It's in another language or it's in Latin. It's in a typescript that's very hard to read. And what it encourages you to do is to roam, to use your eyes, to really try to experience the visual sensations of the work.
Now, of course, with your beautiful edition that's out, Serafini was asked, it must have been by you probably, to make a statement on this book. It's pretty short. It's about 2 pages. And in the end, he says that he didn't write it, and he felt like maybe he shouldn't even deserve the copyright privileges because his cat wrote it. What do you think of the cat? Tell me more about what he meant there.
I think it's wonderful. He thinks after thinking about why the book became that it was the result of the cat's dreams, and he ciphered them onto the page. What I love about that is the cat was apparently perched on his shoulders or fell asleep on his shoulders while he was working. And if the tail wagged to the left, then it would result in a folktale that he would draw, and to the right a song. And I just thought that was so poetic and wonderful. And who couldn't fall in love with him, with the book, and indeed with the cat?
Charles Myers, publisher of Rizzoli Press, talking about Luigi Serafini's Codex Serafinianus. He spoke with Charles Monroe Kane. Want to see it? There are some gorgeous illustrations in the book, and you'll find them on our website at ttbook.org. Does a book have to be real to be magical? In many ways, the Codex isn't really a book. You can't read it. It is bound. It has the structure of a book. Now, our next magic book takes us into murkier territory. It is the Book of Pythia, which is part of the sacred scrolls of the 12 tribes of Kobol. Maybe I should mention that the Book of Pythia is part of a television show. In the 4 seasons of the reimagined Battlestar Galactica, the Book of Pythia plays a crucial role. Maybe a fictional universe, but the book is real. The Book of Pythia was designed by famed prop master Ken Harlew. He says it felt like making a sacred text.
It's leather-bound. The pages are sort of a beautiful texture, ivory cream color, and it has pages of text as you'd see in, yeah, it really is, for want of a better description, it's like an illustrated Bible in a way. But it's black and white illustrations that have been hand-colored, various holy sites in the pantheist religion that become touchstones and guideposts for the journey back to their home planet. the text is in a variety of languages. There's also, I think there's even a little bit of Sanskrit in there. We worked some in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Just to give little sort of interesting little things to the people that, you know, go to the trouble to freeze frame and look at things closely on TV.
How is this different from the sort of, forgive me, the general run of creating props? It seems to me that this is awfully detailed for something that, other than those freeze frame fanatics, hardly anybody's going to see.
Well, yeah, but I think those are the people that you really have to appeal to, and those are the people that you're making this for, because they are the ardent fans, and they are the people that are going to keep coming back and watching the show. And so it has to be worthwhile for them. Also, too, I think we owe it to the quality of the show. It's what really appealed me about it is when I heard about the show is when I saw what they were trying to do with it, was that it was a reimagining, but it was also a very adult version of science fiction as opposed to, you know, I won't slag the original, but it was very kind of Star Wars-y, Buck Rogers kind of, as compared to what we did. So there was a commitment to quality on the show that you rarely get in television. I've been very fortunate to work on two shows like that. One was The X-Files. It also, where I really kind of made my bones in the world of paper props and creating this kind of thing, because the attention to detail is really great there, because once again it has to look real. And one of the key things that we really strive for on this show was, because it was science fiction and because it was, you know, there were a lot of things where we had to suspend disbelief, the rule of thumb is always when doing these kinds of shows for me and I got this from Chris Carter originally in The X-Files, but also Ron Moore subscribed to this: the things that you have control over, you make as real as possible, and then the things where you have to suspend disbelief, then people will come along with you. If those things that are supposed to be real are real, then they'll believe the things that are fantastic.
Is there a difference, do you think, in creating a book prop, a paper prop, than, oh, I don't know, creating a gun, a stun gun?
Yeah, there is. I mean, like I said, I always do these things for two things. The reason why I do these is these kind of paper props as detailed as I do is A, to service the story. That's our main goal. The other thing, too, is that you have to realize this is going to an actor's hand. So you want it to look as realistic and believable for that performer as possible, because if at the very least it should help them with their performance, what you don't want it to do is distract or detract from their performance. So if they're looking at something and it's just gibberish and it takes them out of character for that split second, that shows up on the screen. So you want to be able to help them with the performance. So we did a lot of the files we did for Battlestar Galactica had very detailed information on. Edward James Olmos always commented on how much it helped him with his performance, because it always had the right information in it. So he was never taken out of the scene, and that's really important. With a book like the Book of Pythia, you really want it to feel and look as real as possible, not just for the camera and for the audience, but for the actor also, because I think it helps make their performance more believable.
Battlestar Galactica, of course, is a post-apocalyptic story. The books we see are the only ones that are left in the whole universe. There aren't any more, and they can't make more.
That's right, yeah. Books became, it's funny because there's a great scene in the miniseries where people were evacuating. They're leaving their planet because they're being annihilated by the Cylons, the nuclear explosions everywhere, and they're running for cover and they're trying to get into escape ships and carrying their most prized possessions. There was a great shot of a guy that had a huge stack of books that he was carrying across a field, and those things are important to people. And this is a one of a kind, because this was the only one left, and it became the holy book for what was left of what they thought was humanity.
Has it changed the way you think about books?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I the thought that went into it really, really makes me appreciate how important the written word is, and how much power there is in that. And it's funny because I'm telling tales out of school here a little bit, but at the beginning of the show, Ron Moore and his wife hosted a party for some of the people in the show at their place here in Vancouver, and they had above the buffet where they were serving drinks and they had food there, they had huge wall-sized blow-ups of each of them had taken their favorite page of their favorite book and put it up on the wall. And it gave you a real insight into who they were. and it made me know Ron Moore a little bit more, and that was great. But it really was such a graphic illustration of the power of the written word and how much that can mean.
Did you ever, I mean, you paid a lot of attention to this, and you wanted the actors to feel as though it was the real thing. Was there ever a moment when you looked at it and opened it up and thought, this could be real?
Well, it's interesting you ask that question, because there is a part of me that really wants to believe the ancient astronaut kind of theory of how that it's sort of put forward in the series about how there are humans out in the somewhere in the universe that are trying to find their way back to Earth, and that at one time populated the Earth. And there's so many things in our past history, in various holy books, and in anomalies in history, that you look at the book and you think, you know, it does spark your imagination. What if? And I try and keep an open mind about everything, but it definitely does capture your imagination.
Prop master Ken Harlew talking about the Book of Pythia from the reimagined Battlestar Galactica. One of our producers, Stephanie Youngblood, actually owns one of the Books of Pythia. And if you want to see it, go to our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. To the Best of Our Knowledge is partnering with the radio show Israel Story, or Sipur Israeli, an Israeli version of This American Life. It's one of the most popular new radio shows in Israel, and over the next few months, we will be collaborating on radio pieces that will air on both TT Book and Israel Story. The show's co-founder and host, Mishi Harman, tells the story you're about to hear, along with journalist Matty Friedman. Here's Mishi.
There's one book, an ancient one, more than 1,000 years old, which stands at the center of one of the most fascinating mysteries in Jewish history. Over the centuries, this book was concealed, venerated, pillaged, salvaged, smuggled, made to disappear, and miraculously appear once more. That book is the Aleppo Codex. Today, part of it is displayed as a national treasure in Jerusalem. And part of it is a kind of holy grail sought worldwide by professors, rabbis, spies, and collectors. Together, these people, enthralled by the magic of this codex and its story, make up a sort of underground society. For them, this book is much more than just a book. Matty Friedman encountered them completely by chance.
It was the summer of 2008. I was a reporter here in Jerusalem, and I was kept busy covering the endless routine of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but I was desperate to write about something else, about anything else. One day I was at the Shrine of the Book in Jerusalem at Israel's National Museum, which is where the Dead Sea Scrolls are kept. Everyone knows the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're celebrities. They're the Beyoncé of ancient Hebrew manuscripts. The Scrolls Gallery was full of tourists who were looking at these 2,000-year-old fragments of parchment. A flight of stairs led down from that gallery into a dark room. It was essentially a basement, and it was empty. And there I encountered another book. And from the labels, I understood that this was the singular, perfect copy of the Hebrew Bible, probably Judaism's most important manuscript, and it was one of the most important and valuable books on earth, but I had never heard of it. That gap between its importance and its anonymity seemed to me to be worth exploring.
Adolfo Reutmann is the museum curator in charge of the Codex.
The magic of the Aleppo Codex is that this manuscript is the most significant traditional version of the Hebrew Bible. You know, it's a kind of metaphor of the presence of God on earth. It's the word of God, and the book itself was revered by Jews for centuries, seeing this book as the real presence of God.
Okay. So what does being the perfect version of the Hebrew Bible even mean?
Well, take a religious institution like the Catholic Church, for example. The church is held together by a central office, which is called the Vatican, and it's in Rome, and it sets doctrine and appoints clergy, and it runs the church. But Judaism never had anything like that. And after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD and the beginning of the exile, there was very little holding these diaspora communities together. For a people, dispersion had always meant extinction. And if the Jews were going to be an exception, and they very much wanted to be an exception, they needed a mechanism that would allow them to somehow stay one people, even though they were now speaking different languages and they were answering to different kings. And the mechanism needed to be portable because they were now moving around the world. And what they came up with was the idea that a people could be held together by words. They would have a book that they would all read. And this book is the collection of texts that we know as the Hebrew Bible. But the mechanism only works if they're all reading exactly the same book, because any variations would quickly lead to fragmentation, to religious schism. So you need an agreed upon master copy, a kind of atomic clock of Judaism. And that is the Aleppo Codex, the authoritative version of the Bible.
The Codex was written around 930 AD on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. After that, it was moved to Jerusalem, seized by the soldiers of the First Crusade, and then ransomed by the Jews of Cairo. In Cairo, it was actually the personal Bible used by the great Jewish philosopher and physician Moses Maimonides. A few generations later, it traveled from Cairo north to Aleppo, a trading center in Syria, where it became the treasured possession of the city's Jewish community. It remained there, hidden in the great synagogue in a safe with two locks for 600 years. Rina Sutton, who lives in Israel and is now in her 80s, still remembers the mystique around the Codex.
During the holidays, or on special occasions like bar mitzvahs, they would take the Codex out of its grotto and parade it among the congregants, and everyone lined up to kiss it because it had power. If a woman was trying to get pregnant, she'd get close and touch it. Anyone with a special request would come near.
The Jews of Aleppo came to believe that the book protected their community. It was their talisman. Here's Rina's husband, Rafi, also from Aleppo.
Many legends and beliefs got tied up with the book. If it were ever moved, if it ever left Aleppo, a horrible plague would strike the community. Leprosy, or even worse, total destruction. All kinds of dark things.
So this all sounds kind of dramatic, but it's pretty close to what ended up happening. Today, there are no Jews left in Aleppo. It's the largest city in Syria, a major battlefield between Assad's government and the rebel forces. And it makes you wonder what would have happened if the Codex were still there. Books, after all, don't fare well in wars.
Egypt? No. Soviet Union? Yes. United Kingdom? Abstain. The United States? Yes.
On November 29, 1947, the United Nations voted on the partition of the British Mandate in Palestine into two states, one for the Arabs and one for the Jews. The next day, riots erupted in Aleppo. A mob burned Jewish homes and businesses, and also the Great Synagogue, where the Codex was kept. The book disappeared. And most people thought that it was lost for good. But 10 years later, Mati explains, it resurfaced in mysterious circumstances, this time in Jerusalem, in the new state of Israel.
It turned out that the Codex had actually survived. It had been hidden first by a Christian merchant and then by a Jewish merchant in the old Aleppo Bazaar before it was smuggled out of Syria by a Jewish family who hid it in their washing machine. It reached Turkey, and then it traveled by sea to Haifa, which is an Israeli port, and from there to Jerusalem in early 1958. It ended up in an important academic institute called the Ben Tzvi Institute, which was founded by Israel's second president, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who was also a scholar and, I guess you could say, an early member of the Aleppo Codex Underground. He had been obsessed with the book since the 1930s, and he had done everything in his power to bring it to Jerusalem, including a failed attempt a few years earlier to use the Mossad to smuggle it out of Syria. Now, in 1958, he finally got his wish. He had the book. When the Codex arrived in Jerusalem, two questions arose. One was, who owned Judaism's greatest book? Was it the community that had cherished it and cared for it for 600 years, or was it the new state of Israel? And that question became the subject of a fascinating legal battle that was fought in a court in Jerusalem over 4 years. But the second question is the one that preoccupies the Aleppo Codex Underground to this day. When the book was written more than 1,000 years earlier, it had about 500 pages. But when it turned up in Jerusalem, it had only 294 pages. So about 40% was missing. And the pages that were gone weren't just any pages. They included the Torah, the five books of Moses, which is the most important part of any Hebrew Bible manuscript. And there were other books missing as well, like Daniel, Esther, and a few others.
So what did people think had happened?
Well, the accepted belief was that the pages had been lost in the fire in the Great Synagogue in 1947. The physical appearance of the codex seemed to support that idea because on the bottom outer corner of each page, there is a purplish discoloration that looks like a burn mark. So for years, people just assumed that that was what happened, and it was convenient because if the pages had been burned, you didn't have to look for them. But in 1986, the book was sent for restoration, and a manuscript expert took a close look at these burn marks, and he sent samples to a microbiology lab. And when the slides came back, the expert told me he literally jumped out of his chair because the slides showed clearly that the purple marks weren't burn marks. They were fungus. And in fact, there was no evidence at all that the codex had ever been damaged by fire.
If they hadn't been destroyed in a fire, where were the missing pages? They had immense value to collectors, to Aleppo exiles, and to scholars. And because there are no known copies or photographs of the Codex, the absence of the pages means that the original perfect text of the Bible can't be recreated. In the 1980s, two fragments surfaced, a page from the Book of Chronicles, and a fragment from Exodus with a few passages describing the plague of frogs which God sent to afflict Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Both fragments were found in, of all places, Brooklyn, New York, where they were held by Aleppo Jews who had immigrated to the U.S., and who believed that the pages of the Codex had the power to protect them against the evil eye. At first, researchers were really excited. They hoped that the discovery of these pages would lead to the rest of the missing pieces, but they never did. More than 200 pages remain missing. Since then, nothing else has ever turned up. The mystery continues. And that is where the Aleppo Codex Underground comes in.
Early in my research, I found myself sitting in the living room of an 80-year-old ex-Mossad agent named Rafi Sutton. He was born in Aleppo and escaped to Israel as a teenager. He knew I was looking for information about the Aleppo Codex, and I knew that he had been investigating the story for years. So he puts an enormous file folder on his coffee table, and then he looks at me. I was thrilled because for a reporter, a folder full of yellowing documents is like a juicy hamburger in front of a starving man. But it soon became clear to me that he had no intention of actually letting me see what was inside the folder. This was a guy whose profession was trading in information and secrets. He spent time abroad undercover. He had run agents in the Jordanian sector of Jerusalem in the 50s. And spies like that don't just give information away. And I think that was my first introduction to the underground. Another key figure is a guy named Ezra Kassin, who's in his 40s. He did his military service as a young man, as a detective in the military police, and later ran a center for the study of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism. And he can describe the Great Synagogue of Aleppo in meticulous detail.
אני פונה שמאלה, יורד כמה מדרגות, מולי השער הראשי של בית הכנסת.
I turn left, go down a flight of stairs, and now I'm standing in front of the main gate of the synagogue, and I can already feel the sanctity, a sense of awe completely engulfing me. There's like an inner trembling and excitement, a sense that I'm in the midst of heightened spiritual ecstasy. I push the really heavy, huge wooden doors. The hinges creak, the door opens, and I enter. Now, I find myself walking down a long corridor leading to a small grotto where the Holy Codex is kept. It's the object of our prayers, the ancient and holy treasure of our community.
What's amazing is that Ezra is describing a place that he has never seen. He was born in Israel years after the Codex arrived from Syria. His home is packed with binders of material on the Codex that he's collected. And his wife, who I also got to know over the years that I worked on this book, she knows that she has to share her home with Ezra's other true love. Ezra probably has more information on the Codex than anyone else alive. But as was the case with Rafi, the first time I met him, I got nowhere. He would say things like, you know, Mati, one wrong word to someone in this story and 10 other doors will slam shut. And then he would kind of look at me with a sly grin and he wouldn't say anything more.
So was this frustrating to you?
It was, but it also tipped me off to the existence of a good story that was being concealed. And after a few months of persistence, the doors cracked open.
Slowly, Mati gained more trust as he began to become a part of the underground himself. He learned that there were significant cracks in the official story.
Rafi Sutton, the retired spy, found an elderly rabbi from Aleppo who was by then living in Buenos Aires, and he turned out to be a very reliable witness. The rabbi told him explicitly on camera that he had seen the manuscript whole in 1952. That's 5 years after the riot in Aleppo and the fire in the synagogue, which is when the pieces were supposed to have gone missing. But the rabbi said no, that was not what happened at all.
What that meant was that the pages went missing sometime after the rabbi saw them, and there weren't that many options. Either when the book was being guarded in hiding by the Jews of Aleppo, or in transit through Turkey, or, and this was the most explosive potential conclusion, after it reached Israel and was being held by the scholars of the President's Institute.
One of my first questions was, when was the first time someone wrote down which pages were missing? And I thought this would be easy to find out, but of course, like everything with the Codex, it turned out not to be. After spending a lot of time in archives, I realized that no one had noted how much was missing or that the Torah was missing before March 1958, which is a decade after the fire, and it's after the Codex arrived in the hands of the president. I also started finding evidence that there were other valuable books missing from the collection at the same institute. The academics, who are the custodians of the Codex today and who I at first saw as neutral observers who I could consult with about this very complicated story, they clammed up and eventually refused to cooperate or provide me with documents that I requested, even when I filed a request under Israel's Freedom of Information Act.
But why was that, Mati?
That'll take a long time to answer. Their refusal, of course, made me more curious. And by this time, I thought of myself as a member of the Aleppo Codex Underground, and I would meet Ezra or Rafi or some of the others, and we would trade secrets and fragments of information.
I asked Mati what he thinks it is about the Codex that sparks this kind of obsession. Jews have a long love affair with books. They aren't known as the people of the book for nothing. Texts were the way Jews maintained their identity over centuries in the diaspora. And there has traditionally been a deep regard for words. For example, when a Torah scroll is taken out in a synagogue, the congregation stands up on their feet like you would stand up when a judge enters the courtroom. And the scrolls often are decorated with a silver crown as if they were some sort of royalty. But Mati actually thinks that there's something even deeper going on here.
There's a central idea in Jewish mysticism that the world was once whole and that it then shattered into many fragments. And the universe is broken and it needs to be put back together, and we do this by our good deeds. And the end of the process is redemption. I love the idea that is taught by many mystical traditions over the centuries and millennia that the journey is actually the point. The journey is as important as the destination. It's not coincidence that Ezra Kassin of the Aleppo Codex Underground is also a scholar of Kabbalah, which is the mystic tradition. Because in this story, you have the meeting of these two Jewish preoccupations, the desire to make things whole and the love for the written word. It's an attempt to collect missing pieces, the pieces of a book. And I think that the idea here, consciously or not, is that if we put the Aleppo Codex back together, we'll actually be restoring something much, much greater.
Mishy Harman is co-founder and host of the radio show Israel Story. You can find out more about Israel Story at ttbook.org. Journalist Mati Friedman is the author of the Aleppo Codex, in pursuit of one of the world's most coveted, sacred, and mysterious books, which won the 2013 Sammy Rohr Prize. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. A book can be magical in different ways. There's the beauty of the written word, the escape that comes from an intricate plot. But listen, not all magic is pixie dust and good vibes. The magic of a book can also exert a power that is negative. Take, for example, an illiterate slave whose owner uses the Bible to justify slavery. Imagine what the Bible must have looked like to that slave. Shireen Sherrod Johnson is an English professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She says we know a lot about how slaves looked at books because of the hundreds of slave narratives they wrote. A fundamental trope in those narratives is what is called the talking book. Steve Paulson sat down with Sherrod Johnson.
Shireen, let's start with the basic question. What is the talking book?
So the talking book is a trope in African-American literature, and many people refer to it as the trope. A trope is just a recurring image or an idea that comes up again and again, and often with some difference or even evolution. The idea of the trope is that people see this as an originary idea in terms of the beginning of the African-American literary tradition. And so that's essentially what the talking book is. It comes out of a book by Henry Louis Gates called The Signifying Monkey, published in the late 80s. And from that idea, you have many of the thoughts that deal with the tension between literacy and orality. Mm-hmm. So it really tries to connect those two things.
Can you take me back to the first talking books? Can you give me an early example?
Right. So the first talking books came out of early African-American literature. And when people think about that, they usually think of slave narratives. And certainly one of them comes out of a slave narrative by Olodua Equiano, who wrote a slave narrative in the 18th century that is part memoir, part autobiography, part adventure, seafaring narrative. And so he has this instance where he talks about seeing a book and engaging with this idea of literacy in the Western tradition. That is the Enlightenment tradition, in the sense that being a man of letters is what made you a thinking being. And this was important in a period in which human beings were being turned into commodities. Just to give you an example, I think I can read one from Equiano, and then you'll see how there are two examples that I have, and I think the two together show exactly what the talking book was at its inception. So the first one comes from Equiano's narrative. I had often seen my master and Dick employed in reading, and I had a great curiosity to talk to the books, as I thought they did, and so to learn how all things had a beginning. And for that purpose, I have often taken up a book and have talked to it, and then put my ears to it when alone, in hopes it would answer me. And I have been very much concerned when I found it remain silent. So in this example, the talking book talks to others, right? Does not talk to Equiano.
It's an untalking book.
It is an untalking book.
And just to put this in perspective, so these were slaves who had come from an oral tradition in Africa. And I can just imagine that when they were then in slavery, they would see their masters reading from a book, often the Bible, and I mean reading and then talking. And it must have seemed like the book itself was talking.
Was speaking to them, yeah. And that is often how it is described. Over time, the idea of this book as a mystical object, as a fetish, as an object of power changed as these enslaved Africans who had been transformed into commodities realized that there was power in that book, and in perhaps desiring to master the book, to get the book to talk to them was in fact then a goal. And that is very much very tied into the early beginning of the literary tradition with regards to slave narratives wanting to tell their own stories. So it's got an interesting tension there.
Well, this is such a complicated history here, such a fascinating history, because on the one hand, you're talking about the empowerment that comes with literacy, with learning to read and write. And so that it's not just sort of, oh, the slave master is reading this book, and you know, it's as if the book itself is taught. I mean, I can take on that tradition. I can make the book talk in a way. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's you're also talking about this literary tradition that's going up against the oral tradition in some way. It's almost as if you're losing something as you become literate.
Right. And as we move through the 19th century, you have slaves beginning to write their own stories and often using in their subtitles or part of their titles written by himself or written by herself. And many of them position those moments when they learn to read, many of them begin to equate that with freedom or with the steps towards freedom. Frederick Douglass famously does that when he talks about how reading certain documents enabled him to understand himself as a thinking person and then began to actually make him uneasy about his situation, right? So he really connects this idea of enlightenment to literacy. But then others begin to question that, thinking, well, people knew they weren't free before they knew how to read, right? When reading doesn't necessarily make you aware of that. And that's where within this literature you begin to see these tensions between the oral tradition and the value of that versus a written tradition that's associated with power and in some cases oppressive power, right? If we think about the way that the Bible, certainly it was a magic book that slaves wanted to gain mastery of, but it was also a book that people interpreted in ways that helped to oppress the population as well.
Well, of course, the Bible has this fascinating history. Speaking of double-voiced or double-edged, I mean, the Bible was used by slave owners to justify slavery. I mean, there are passages in the Bible that justify, but there are other passages that justify liberation, freedom, the story of Exodus. And so, you know, you can interpret the Bible in these two different ways. I mean, specifically regarding the whole issue of slavery.
Right. And I think that issue of interpretation was why enslaved Africans strove to gain literacy, right, so they could read it for themselves, interpret it for themselves, and then begin to use those arguments, those moral arguments, in the service of abolition. And that probably, in terms of mastery of a text, was one of the most significant turns, right, into, or at least in the early stages when writing was really fused with political activism.
Right. So what happens to this tradition of the talking book as we move ahead in history into the late 19th or 20th century? I mean, does that tradition of the talking book still survive?
Well, I think it does in the sense that the tension or that combination between wanting to preserve oral histories within literary ones, you do see it especially in the historic fiction of the late 20th century and early 21st century. Writers like Toni Morrison, who write historical novels about slavery, you see the books appear in those texts. And the books are not always – print isn't always favorable.
What would be an example of that in, say, a Toni Morrison novel?
Well, she writes about the book a lot. And I think probably, I want to say, her best example of thinking about this idea of the talking book is probably the book Jazz. But I feel like in Beloved, you have Setha realizing or beginning to understand partly the way in which she's been dehumanized because she sees the school teacher, who's her master, writing about her in this book, right? She doesn't know what he's writing, but she knows that there's something pernicious about it. So in that case, the book has power, but it has the kind of power that she actually has to counter with her own oral narrative. So throughout Beloved, Setha is always telling her story, right, in different ways, even though she very often wants to repress the story. And one of the most powerful moments in Beloved, without totally spoiling it for those who haven't read it at this point, is when the figure of Beloved, who may or may not be the ghost of Setha's murdered daughter, is exorcised by 30 singing women. And the way it's described is they utter the sound that broke the back of words. And it's this beautiful moment, but it's interesting to think of that notion of needing to break the back of words, right, to counter something that is written with the power, the collective oral power of these women or the community coming together.
Do you think there still is this tension between the oral tradition and the written word mm-hmm. today, especially within African-American circles?
I think that you see it now probably most prominently, and I wouldn't necessarily call it a division, but with the popularity of spoken word poetry that is primarily performed. Now, poetry has always had that performative aspect, especially African-American poetry. There's always been this attentiveness to the line, to rhythm, to timing. So in many ways, these traditions are really fused, but there are authors who really feel strongly that the poem has to also work on the page. And so they are very much connected to the book in that way, that they see themselves as poets who write poetry that's meant to be written and that has to look a very particular way. It's structured in a certain form. It might function as an oral text as well, but the primary importance is how it looks and how it reads on the page, whereas there are also spoken word artists that really don't see the page as their medium, right? They're freed up to present their work in different forms, almost as dramatic monologues. They are very much tied to stand-up. They're tied to the tradition of hip-hop and toast-telling, right, which very much goes back to this idea of exchanging lies, as Zora Neale Hurston would have called them. So I think that tension is still present there, but I do feel like there is something freeing, perhaps, in getting off or getting away from the book in that way. And I do feel like digital media, in allowing us to begin to both hear and see words moving in really innovative ways, is an interesting connection, I think, between the two, right? Mm. So that the page is now the screen, and the way in which lines don't stay in one place anymore, and you can both hear them and see them at the same time. So that might be a unique way of how these oral and written traditions are still continuing to fuse together.
Shireen Sherard Johnson on The Talking Book in African-American Literature. She's a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Steve Paulson spoke with her. G. Willow Wilson's novel Alif the Unseen is one of those books that is almost impossible to label. Is it fantasy? Maybe literary fiction? Dystopia? How about techno-crime noir? Or as the New York Times put it, an exemplar of Islamic mysticism with ties to the work of the Sufi poets. As Anne Strainchamps discovered, Alif the Unseen is steeped in an even older tradition. It is a book of magic about a book of magic.
So in terms of the magic that you bring into the book, it comes actually in the form of an old book. This is something that kind of falls into Aleph's lap and is, what is it called, The 1001 Days?
Yes, it is. And that is actually based on a real book written by a French nobleman who was a diplomat in the Persian court under the Sun King, Louis XIV. And at the time, the first big 1001 Nights craze was kind of sweeping Europe. It had been translated into French, and so people were mad for these stories, which they'd never seen before. And he brought back these stories that he called Les Mille et Un Jours, the 1001 Days. And it was in many ways an inversion of the 1001 Nights. The frame story is about a young princess who has a dream in which she is a deer, and she's kind of abandoned by a stag, and this tells her that she should never get married because men are untrustworthy and will abandon you in your time of need. And so her father, the king, who's concerned for her future, asks her nurse to tell her stories that will make her feel better about the idea of marriage and might sort of bring her around to the idea of getting married. And so there's some wonderful stories that kind of spin out from there. And the consensus is that it was probably a fake. He claimed that he heard these stories from Persian mystics, but the consensus is that he probably made them up. But I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if he was telling the truth, and that not only were these stories passed down through Persian mystics, but that they got them from the jinn, these hidden fairy-like creatures that exist in Islamic mythology, and that these stories were actually the key to some kind of arcane knowledge that we weren't meant to have. And so in the book, the frame story of Princess Farouqaz is the same, but I made up several, folk tales that are not in the original Mille et un jour to sort of serve the story. because they're sort of this repository in the book for the arcane knowledge of the unseen.
And the way you describe the jinn, nobody can ever quite figure out exactly what they look like, but they seem to be part animal.
Yeah. I mean, typically in Islamic mythology, the jinn are shapeshifters. They're made out of smokeless fire. That's how they're described in the Quran. So they can take many shapes. They can appear like human beings. They can appear like flame or shadow, but they can also take the shapes of animals. And so in the book, I have one genie who takes the shape of a cat, and Vikram, who's sort of the genie who hangs around with the protagonist. You're never quite sure what he looks like. He looks like he could be a man. He could be an animal. How the characters see the jinn is based on their own level of belief, their own openness to the idea that there might be this other unseen world. And so some characters can't see them at all. Some characters see ordinary human beings, and then other characters see horrible monsters.
I wanted to ask you to read a passage I think this is a conversation between Aleph and Vikram, one of the jinn, and Vikram is sort of trying to explain to Aleph something about the parallel world, the world of the jinn that exists side by side with the human world.
Sure. So in this conversation, Aleph is talking with Vikram about the hidden knowledge that the jinn are supposed to possess, and he's trying to explain a little bit about what he means. So Aleph begins by asking, "About your parallel knowledge, what did you mean by that?" "I meant that my race is older than yours. We think about the world differently. We remember the foretime when it was just us and the angels, and your tribe had not yet been created from earth and blood. So we tell stories differently. Oh, they might look the same on the outside, but they have meanings that are hidden from you, just as we ourselves are hidden." Aleph could already feel his interest flagging. It was like listening to the babbling of a madman in the marketplace. One feigned attention, then moved away as quickly as possible. "What does all this have to do with the Alfiyom?" he asked. Vikram sighed. "Your kind was never meant to read the Alfiyom," he said. "You have your own stories and your own knowledge. You are seen and we are hidden. That was the way of things ordained by God before he started the clock on this strange universe. But you are Benu Adam, and always messing with delicate things and transgressing boundaries. At some point, hundreds of years ago, an unscrupulous member of my tribe allowed one of yours to transcribe the Alfiyom. Ever since then, there have been copies floating around the seeing world. Many were lost over time, thought to be only, as you said, a bunch of old stories. But a few remain. That book you have is one of them." Aleph thought for a moment. A nightbird trilled morosely from a nearby hibiscus bush. They had wandered into the oldest part of the souk, silent now except for the occasional domestic sound of an animal in its birth. "So the stories aren't just stories, is what you're saying. They're really secret knowledge disguised as stories. One could say that of all stories, younger brother."
G. Willow Wilson, reading from her novel Aleph the Unseen. Anne Strainsham spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on the magic book, go to our website at ttbook.org. Follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle there is at ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane with the help of Stephanie Youngblood, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.